Number 13-5112, United States of America et al. Versus Bank of America Corporation et al., Wells Fargo Bank N.A., Appellant. Mr. Baruch for the appellant, Ms. Powell for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. And may it please the Court, Douglas Baruch on behalf of the appellant, Wells Fargo Bank. This appeal turns on the proper interpretation of paragraph 3B of the federal release. This court needs to decide a specific question. That is, whether paragraph 3B merely releases False Claims Act and FERIA claims arising from the annual certification form, which by itself doesn't give rise to any False Claims Act or FERIA liability, or whether paragraph 3B releases claims based on the underlying conduct that could give rise to this type of liability.
Your recitation is skipping over the key phrase, sole basis, right?
That's
what we have to wrestle with. What does sole basis mean here?
Sole basis, that's a question that we should get to, but not yet, because the threshold question is whether conduct is released at all. Whether the conduct is the sole basis or not is
I thought the language of the provision was whether the annual certification was the sole basis for the claim. That doesn't say conduct was the sole basis for the claim.
It says that the claim based on a false annual certification of compliance with certain HUD regulations.
Okay.
That Wells Fargo, the certification is false because of conduct. It says very clearly in paragraph 3B what the certification, what would render the certification false, and that is whether Wells Fargo falsely stated that it was conforming with all of the regulations necessary to maintain its HUD or FHA approval, or whether it was otherwise complying with HUD regulations. And if the failures there, the lack of conformance or the lack of compliance, is the sole basis for the liability that the government is now seeking to assert, then it's released. If it's not, then they can move forward. They could establish that. But the district court erred because the district court determined that there was no conduct within the scope of paragraph 3B at all, that the certification was the limit, the outer limit, the document itself was the outer limit of what was being released in paragraph 3B. And that's error. And we've established
Of your argument is that if the settlement had been along the lines of the government suggests that that you would have paid a lot more money, is that right? Or?
We paid a lot of money already.
Yes.
There was $5 billion in consideration for this release. This is one aspect of the release, no question.
Right.
But in order to give meaning to this provision, paragraph 3B, which is a very important and obviously a very highly negotiated provision, it carries on for three pages. In order to give meaning to that, there has to be something that is released. What False Claims Act and FERIA liability could possibly be released based on a certification divorced from the conduct?
What type of claim still exists, do you think? You're reading 3B as saying it's releasing Wells Fargo from liability when the sole basis for the claim relates to the underlying conduct, right, of the annual certification. So what, in your view, what sort of claim still exists and could the government bring?
Sure, there's an express carve-out, and it's in the for avoidance of doubt clause, and it's also in the sole basis clause. And that says that essentially the government can proceed against Wells Fargo based on individual loan-level certifications, separate from annual certifications. Those are the individual certifications by underwriters on a loan-by-loan basis. They certify that they have undertaken the necessary review of the files, and in their opinion, the loan meets the eligibility requirements for FHA. If that certification is false, and if the loan was otherwise ineligible, the government can pursue a claim against Wells Fargo, can try to pursue a claim against Wells Fargo on that basis. What they can't do is what they're doing in New York, and that is they cannot pursue Wells Fargo based on a failure to comply with lender-wide, company-wide policies such as failure to implement a quality control plan.
My understanding is that at the time the complaint was filed that this settlement pertained to, the government had a theory of liability that was if an annual certification is filed that's false or fraudulent, then the bank can be liable for every single loan issued under that certification for a year, I guess it was an annual certification, whether or not the underlying loans were had independent acts of fraud within them. And so even if there was no independent act of fraud, this annual certification umbrella claim would render you liable for everything. You just had no business making these loans through this federal program. Is that understanding correct? If so, isn't that an awful lot of relief that you got from this release, just getting that
table? Sure, Judge Mollett. But first of all, I don't know what kind of liability there would be if the loan didn't ultimately wasn't ineligible. If the loan was eligible, it's hard to imagine that there would be liability arising out of that in the first instance. However, if you go back and you look at the government's complaint in this case, in the underlying case in Bank of America, not the New York action, their allegation against the banks was that it failed to have a quality control plan. That was their allegation. It wasn't this. It was a very specific type of allegation that was being made against the banks.
No, but I think the way law works is that same conduct can give rise to different types of liability. And so, not having a quality control program could make X, Y, and Z loans bad. Falsely certifying the government that you have a quality control program is its own independent violation. And my understanding here is that's what settled, those false certifications that you had these programs, but not what went wrong with those programs.
No, you simply can't divorce. In the False Claims Act world, you can't divorce the certification from the conduct itself. When you look at paragraph 3B, it very specifically says that the annual certification is false because of the failure to comply with certain HUD regulations. And those are very specific regulations, such as the failure to have a quality control plan or the like. And where the government is trying to...
If somebody engages in Medicaid fraud or Medicare fraud, something like that, and they submit a claim that they shouldn't submit, and they also fill out their annual paperwork and their contract with the government to be authorized for the Medicare program, and in there they have a false statement, I think you would agree that the government could pursue those as two independent harms.
They could, perhaps, but not...
Even if the false statement was, I won't do any bad Medicaid billing, which they then did in the individual act.
Perhaps in the Medicare world, maybe there's a Title 18 violation that could be for a false statement, but this is a False Claims Act and a FERIA release here. And the release has to be based on conduct. And again, if you go back to the way Judge Collier misunderstood what was happening here, and that's I think, the important focus. Judge Collier didn't reach the issues that you're now struggling with about the sole basis. Judge Collier stopped with the error that the paragraph 3B only applies to annual certification, the form itself, divorced from the conduct. He says very clearly, it does not release conduct. When you go to the text of paragraph 3B, it describes conduct for certain. And then if you go to paragraph 11, and I urge the court to do that, paragraph 11 has three provisions in it that make absolutely clear that the parties intended to release conduct, because they say it in paragraph 11. Paragraph 11 is a reservation of rights clause. The subparagraphs, and again, this is a 44-page release. It's got a lot of provisions in it. But if you look at paragraph 11E10, which is at the Joint Appendix of paragraph 159, and also 11.02 and 11.03 at 165, in each place, the parties agree that the government is reserving rights, and then it says, quote, except to the extent such conduct is released in paragraph 3B. Except to the extent such conduct is released in paragraph 3B. How can that possibly square with Judge Collier's interpretation that there is no conduct that is released in paragraph 3B?
Couldn't the conduct just be the filing of the false annual certification?
No.
Is that not conduct? Is the filing of a false annual certification document conduct or not?
It's not False Claims Act conduct.
Why
it's not?
For
re- False Claims Act requires that you have a knowing violation of some regulation and that it results in a false claim for payment.
Isn't the submission of this false annual certification itself a source of liability? I mean, isn't that the false claim?
No. I beg to differ, Judge Brown. The False Claims Act liability arises from a false claim for payment. The false claim for payment arises from some misconduct, some failure to comply with a regulation or conform with some other standard that was required to be conformed to.
Well, that's what makes it false.
Right,
so
and
that
that's what the release is about. It's about the conduct that makes the false the certification false. And that's what paragraph 11 says. It says that there is conduct that is being released in paragraph 3B. Judge Collier said there is no conduct being released in paragraph 3B. If the intent of the parties was to limit this provision to a release for a false statement alone, why does it go on for four pages? Why does it have carve-outs? Why does it describe the conduct that would make the certification false? How can you possibly reconcile paragraph 11, which says paragraph 3B releases conduct? How can you reconcile paragraphs, recitals C and D, which say that the parties agree that claims are based on conduct? The parties themselves in this document do not divorce or separate claims from conduct. And you can't have this artificial separation solely for paragraph 3B.
I guess they do because they talk about conduct, like the language you were talking about, covered origination conduct, covered servicing conduct, and in the relevant release language, it talks about claims.
It talks about claims and describes the conduct in paragraph 3B. Judge, I understand that there, for naming convention purposes, they define servicing conduct and origination conduct, and they didn't define annual certification conduct as a defined term. That makes no difference in our view. The fact is that they describe conduct within paragraph 3B and elsewhere in the document itself, of which, of course, the court needs to read as a whole, consistent with contract interpretation principles. You have to look at every provision, and you have to try to reconcile those provisions with the language that's at issue. In there, they describe it as a release of conduct.
You said one thing that was critical was that you have to have a violation of the regulation for the False Claims Act. Are there regulations that require truthfulness in filing the annual certification?
The regulations that – I don't know the answer to that. There's a certification on the form itself that I suppose you're certifying that is accurate. Sure. But that's not what the allegations were about.
I'm just asking the question because you said violation of regulations is important. Whether there
I don't know whether there's a separate regulation that deals with that.
Is it not true that if you do this certification, every loan you issue is entitled to FHA insurance?
That is not true.
That's not true.
No, the annual certification is a certification that's required for lenders to be able to participate in the program. It says that the lender
has... Every loan that you do participating in that program gets FHA insurance?
No, not automatically. No, there's a separate... That's a very good point because there's a separate certification. That goes to Judge Griffith's point about what's left here. There's a separate certification individually. Every single loan, first you get to be a lender. You're an approved lender because you've certified that you've undertaken the necessary approvals. You've conformed with the HUD handbook that deals with lender approval to be able to issue loans. And then on an individual loan basis, you have to have an individual underwriter certify separately in a different form that they properly underwritten that loan and that it meets the standards necessary to have HUD to be insured by FHA. That's the path forward that the government has here. That's the carve-out. What they can't do is what they're doing in New York again. They're seeking to impose liability on Wells Fargo based solely on annual certification conduct, that Wells Fargo failed to conform with the standards necessary to maintain its HUD FHA lender approval. That's what they're doing there. Judge Collier never got to that point because she got hung up erroneously on whether paragraph 3B released conduct at all. And in our view, you cannot, you can't reconcile the rest of the text. You can't have an, you can't have a an interpretation of paragraph 3B that divorces claims from conduct. So what we suggest respectfully is that this court determine, find that paragraph 3B does actually release some conduct and remand the case back to Judge Collier to for the next step, which would be to apply that interpretation to the conduct of the government and determine whether that conduct is violating the terms of the consent decree.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Berger.
May it please the Court, Lindsay Powell for the United States. The relevant portion of paragraph 3B expressly releases only those claims that are based solely on the submission to HUD of a false annual certification. That's exactly what the paragraph says. And the relevant conduct there is the submission to HUD of the false annual certification. So the question about claims versus conduct is really beside the point. The paragraph is straightforward.
What type of claim is being brought in Southern District of New York?
An entirely different type of claim. So if I can start with what 3B releases.
It relies on the annual certification, though, doesn't it?
So what the Southern District of New York said is that the annual certifications are largely irrelevant to the government's claims. That was that court's authoritative
construction. Right. How so? How so?
So the claims filed in that case are based primarily on false individual loan certifications. Mm-hmm. All of the loans at issue in that case contain material violations of HUD requirements. And that's what makes them distinct from the types of claims released by paragraph 3B. Liability under 3B, or the theory released by that paragraph, would allow for the government to seek damages for good loans as well as bad. So those that didn't actually contain any material violations based solely on the fact of the false annual certification, which enabled Wells Fargo to participate in the direct endorsement lender program, have the benefits and privileges of participation in that program when it was not actually qualified to be participating. Mm-hmm. So it's that initial false attestation that ends up infecting all of the loans, good and bad, which ends up being a very broad theory of liability.
Has any court accepted that theory of liability?
It's certainly been brought, and claims have been settled in other cases.
But no court has accepted that theory that if you file the same annual certification, if that's false, then you are suddenly liable for every single loan that you did that year, regardless of whether those individual loans had any individualized violations of regulations.
To my knowledge, that hasn't the issue hasn't gone to litigation yet, so there aren't authoritative court decisions, but it's consistent with other theories of False Claims Act liability. And on that point, I do want to clarify the False Claims Act does not require the violation of a regulation for liability to follow. Liability is premised on the false making of a false or fraudulent statement to the government in order to obtain something of benefit from the government. And that's exactly what you have here, is the government paying insurance claims on these loans, again, both good and bad, because of participation in the direct endorsement lender program.
It strikes me that the New York complaint, it seems a bit slippery, because the New York complaint, while you characterize it as individual loans, actually talks about loans en masse. And the reason you suspect these hundreds or thousands of loans are all bad is because there wasn't a quality control program, and all these things that are in the annual certification, and you even talk about annual certification in some of the claims there. And so it seems to me that you have sort of stripped what was ever, under your theory, of what was settled in this complaint down to virtually nothing. What exactly did they get in exchange for their $5 billion?
So, Your Honor, there are many things in the release other than paragraph 3B as well. So the release provided by 3B is itself quite significant, again, because the government could otherwise seek damages for these good loans as well as bad under this broad global theory. But the district court case in DDC was actually primarily about servicing misconduct. So in addition to the type of origination misconduct that we've been talking about in the briefs in this case, what was really at issue there were misconduct by the banks with respect to conduct in undertaking foreclosures, bankruptcy proceedings, and much of the relief obtained consistent with that is consumer relief for existing loan holders and a series of servicing standards with which the banks would have to comply in their conduct with borrowers going forward. So that was the heart of the case there, and much of the relief goes to that. I think paragraph 2A of the release is particularly illustrative there. You can see the breadth of the servicing conduct releases juxtaposed with the origination conduct releases. So there you see that the government releases servicing claims under a large number of enumerated statutes and any others under which the civil division has authority to bring or settle claims. It's also notable that... I'm sorry, Your Honor. It's 139 to 40. And what's striking about that is both the reference to the entire category of covered servicing conduct, whereas in paragraph 3B, you don't see a similarly broad reference to covered origination conduct. You have the more specific reference to claims that are based solely on the submission of a false annual certification. So that contrast is striking. But also notable is the broad release with respect to claims under any statute or regulation that the government would have authority to bring.
I want to make certain I understand the government's view of what's taking place here, what this agreement was about. Are you saying that Wells Fargo paid $5 billion so that the government couldn't bring a claim against it in which the proof that was offered was simply the annual certification? That what they were getting for their $5 billion was that if the government was going to bring a claim against them, they had to show something more than that? They had to show in the individual loan that there was some separate act of false statement? Is that the gist of the settlement agreement?
There are two parts to the answer, Your Honor. One is that they were getting much more than just what's in paragraph 3B. And that really is substantial. I mean, that was the focus of the suit and the settlement was on this servicing misconduct. But 3B itself, yes, the submission of the false annual certification, because it's a threshold to participation in the direct
enforcement. So it's just the government saying, if we're going to bring a case against you, we're going to have to bring more than just the annual certification.
Right, and why that's so significant is because the theory that's based on the false annual certification would make the bank liable for good loans as well as bad loans that don't actually themselves contain material violations. Okay. Okay. And while there is a lot going on in the SDNY complaint.
But that gets, I think, to Judge Millett's question. Where did this theory come from? You're obviously basing it on a theory that you had the right and the likelihood of recovering against Wells Fargo on good loans in which there was no misrepresentation made. Where did that idea come from?
Well, the misrepresentation is made, Your Honor, in making the false annual certification in order to gain entry to this government program. And but for gaining that entry, no claims would have been paid by FHA on those loans.
Are there other areas you can point us to where there's Medicare or whatever, I mean, criminal contract, wherever false claims are put in? So you have this theory that one false claim, i.e. the annual certification, opens the door to liability for everything you did that year, false or not?
Because that is the position from which you're negotiating the settlement agreement, isn't it? Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And we, I
mean, so where did that come from?
It is a theory that in this context, the government has brought in numerous cases. So
I know you brought it against some other banks, and I'm just asking, are there outside this context, or is this something that's created just for purposes of this annual certification in this particular setting? Because I had assumed that this was some grander False Claims Act theory that you had already exercised against other industries.
Yes, so there are some analogies, and we cited them in our filing in the Deutsche Bank case. So courts have found claims to be factually similar insofar as a fraudulent scheme taints all of the claims submitted to the government in United States versus Hess, which is 317 U.S. 537. There it held that a subcontractor was liable under the False Claims Act where its bid rigging scheme caused the contractor to present inflated claims to the government. United States versus Bornstein, 423 U.S.
That just sounds like they were liable for false things that they did. in this case?
So in the cases that I'm referring to here, there it's similarly is a threshold statement or falsehood that rendered subsequent conduct false. But I think the crucial thing...
Right, but the point here is it doesn't render subsequent conduct false. You can have a perfectly legitimate, proper loan that would come through, and you would still say, too bad, you have to pay damages.
Right.
I'm not sure what the damages are, but you have to pay something for that.
Well, it's a loan that never would have been insured by the government, but for the false statement.
But if nothing went wrong with the loan, I'm not sure what your damages would be.
Well, if it
went through and it defaulted, I guess, is your theory?
Yes, that's what we're talking about, claims that defaulted so that the government is actually paying the insurance.
So it's not everything they did that year, it's everything they did that defaulted that year?
Yes, that's what we mean by claims paid. It's when they go to default and the insurance claim is actually paid. So
there are other things that you pay even for something that doesn't go into default in this process?
What we're talking about with this theory are those that go through the default process and go to claim so that there is a payment by the government that's, again, premised at the outset on the false statement that gains the bank access to this program in the first instance.
I'm sorry, go ahead. To
follow up on that, can you describe for me what is the difference in the scope of the claims that you think are left versus what Mr. Baruch thinks are left? Because you both said individual loan level certification, right? So are you talking about the same thing, or do you have a different idea of what falls within that?
Two things, Your Honor. One, I think the parties are looking at the New York complaint differently when we're talking about what these individual loan level violations mean. So the government maintains that the claims stated in there are based on individual loan-level certifications, falsities in those individual loan certifications and material violations in the underlying loans. And that's what the district court in that case found. But I think the other thing that is sort of confusing the parties' discussion of this is the question of what intent is required to establish an individual loan certification violation. And Wells Fargo submits that you need to show the intent of knowing falsehood by the individual underwriter, and that's not the case. It's a question of corporate liability and knowledge by others within the bank who are relying on that false statement with knowledge of these individual deficiencies is sufficient to establish liability. And I think clarifying that goes to resolve some of the confusion between what the parties are talking about.
I have the trouble from their perspective with the New York complaint is that while you say it's about individual loan liability, when you read some sweeping language of the complaint, it sounds like, well, we know 500 loans were bad because you didn't have a quality control program. That thing you certified in your false annual certification, well, that was false, and so therefore you didn't have the quality control program. So all these loans are out. It doesn't actually look like you're planning to prove these up one by one with their own falsehoods and their own individual level certification. Am I misunderstanding your plans in New York?
The material violations do need to be demonstrated with respect to individual loans. There's a question, and the parties reserved this in paragraph 3B, about whether the government can use statistical sampling as a means of evidence. But in terms of the
statistical sampling just shows that these fell under the same false statement that was a predicate for the false annual certification, whether it's not reporting problem or the quality control problem or all these other requirements. Aren't you really sort of having your cake and eating it too?
No, Your Honor. I mean, first, it is significant that the parties reserved the paragraph 3B doesn't speak to whether the government can use statistical sampling or not. So that is an open question. But the SDNY claims do depend in each instance on material violations with respect to each loan. So they do not rely on that
material
threshold
violations
certification.
That are distinct from whatever was false in the annual certification?
Yes, Your Honor. So it may be true that some of these shortcomings resulted from the sort of systemic failure. So because there's no quality control program in place, because underwriters aren't undertaking the proper training, have the wrong incentives, aren't complying with different programs, but that's what leads to bad loans. But absolutely what we're talking about in the SDNY complaint and what the court there found in construing the complaint filed in that court was that these were claims based on material violations in the individual loans, and along with that, false individual loan certification. So for each loan there is a falsity in the individual loan certification.
And that falsity is distinct from something went wrong. It says something was false, distinct from what they allegedly did falsely in their annual certifications, or is it just repeating at that level what was certified at the annual level?
Well, it's distinct, Your Honor, in processing each of these loans, there's a failure to do due diligence and to make sure that the individual borrower satisfies these requirements. So again, those individual failures, in a sense, result from these broader systemic, you know, shortcomings, that there are no appropriate checks in place. But it's
that would make sense to me, except that when you start talking about statistical sampling, which suddenly sounds like you're not going to look at anything individually, you're just going to go, no quality control program, that led to people with bad credit scores or whatever, and really just have a sort of global sweeping condemnations of loans, which are exactly what the annual certification covered.
Your Honor, if you look at pages, I believe it starts at 32, I believe, of the joint appendix, you can see the type of individual loan-based evidence that the SDNY claims assert. So this is a small sampling of claims only among the thousands, but the complaint does go loan by loan through several examples talking about the types of informational failures that led to material violations in these loans. So it's beginning at 332. You can see there's the discussion with respect to the marsh salt property, failures in the due diligence there, the borrower not actually having the necessary assets to qualify to get the loan, and the loan nevertheless being issued. These are the types of violations that the New York complaint is concerned with, and those are distinct from the global theory of liability that's at issue in the DDC action.
I think you also have some, paragraph 140, which is on JA 356, Wells Fargo certified its entire portfolio of retail FHA loans for insurance, and thereby falsely certified the thousands of retail FHA loans that are eligible for insurance, but not. That sounds to me like you just sort of chopped up the annual certification. So some of those, yeah, you got addresses or individuals.
And, Your Honor, I think it's important to distinguish in the SDNY complaint that there are some allegations made as sort of background demonstrating the sort of broader course of dealing here, which goes to knowledge and intent and serves to show how these material violations happen versus what the claims can be said to be based on. And
What's your first claim for relief? So that seems to be the most operative, much more operative than your factual background paragraphs that you pointed me to.
Well, but that same claim also says that a truthful individual loan certification is a condition of payment, and that the payment here was based on the submission of these false individual loan certifications. So again, there's even within that, although the false certification annual certification is referenced in the background, it's not what the claims are based on. And even this reference that Your Honor was reading, that they falsely certified that thousands of retail loans were eligible, that's a reference to the individual loan certifications themselves. So as counsel for Wells Fargo stated, the individual loan certification is required in each instance, and in a large number of instances, that certification was additionally false. And that's what these claims are based on. That's also what the Southern District of New York held when construing the complaint filed in that court. So the question of the scope of the SDNY complaint isn't at present before this court. The question is the scope of paragraph 3C.
What would be Wells Fargo's remedy if, as the SDNY litigation goes forward, the claims suddenly sound more and more alike? Because you have a lot of those things that are very, very sweeping in general in your claims for relief. They thought you were really trespassing on to what was more the global settlement. You're simply chopping up the annual certification and saying, there's 1,000 loans, there's 1,000, there's 1,000. What should they do? Should they raise that with the SDNY, or should they raise that with the district court here?
At this point, given the way the proceedings have unfolded, I think it would be most appropriate to raise that with the SDNY. The DDC reserved, declined to rule on the scope of the SDNY complaint, and the SDNY court did act on that. It's acutely aware of this litigation, of the questions regarding the scope of 3B, and so it seemed that the government's course of litigation in SDNY were encroaching on the release provisions, it would be appropriate to raise it in that court.
Thank you. You had no time remaining. We'll give you 2 minutes.
And can I start you off with a question? I'm looking at JA 145, and I want to help me understand what the language means. It's in the section that begins paren, II, paren. This paragraph does. I'll just read it. This paragraph does not release or otherwise bar the United States from introducing evidence of any alleged failure to comply with applicable HUD FHA requirements, including but not limited to, and then it has a list, in connection with any claim that there was a material violation of applicable HUD requirements with respect to an individual loan or loans that would subject the company or an affiliated entity to liability under the False Claims Act. Well, isn't that exactly what's going on at SDNY?
No.
Okay, why not? How now? How so?
In the Southern District of New York action, the government has a theory that because Wells Fargo failed to comply with these standards, that it engaged in reckless underwriting at the,
right,
at the, not at the individual loan level basis, but when you look at the allegations in the complaint, it's all about what senior management knew or didn't know.
But perhaps I just misunderstood government counsel. I thought that, no, in fact, what's going on in SDNY was claims that individual loan, the way it was originated, underwritten, or whatever, that the certification made in that loan, not quite apart from the annual certification, that there was a False Claims Act claim in that loan. So, am I wrong on that?
I believe you are wrong. What the government says is that certification may have been false, but it was not a false claim. A false claim requires that the individual underwriter knowingly
certify it. But it was separate and apart from the annual certification.
Right. Okay. The individual underwriter, in order for there to be False Claims Act liability.
Well, if it was separate and apart from the annual certification, why does it not fall within this language I just read you?
This is an evidentiary use provision here. It says that the government can use evidence of quality problems within the company to attempt to prove that an individual loan.
I see.
To establish as evidence. For instance, and I know the court's been struggling with some examples of how this might work. If an individual underwriter certified a loan in order to get a commission,
right?
She wanted to plow through the loans quickly in order to get a commission. She didn't do the proper underwriting. She approved a loan that was ineligible in order to get her commission at the end of the month. And that commission is in violation of one of the certifications that Wells Fargo makes in its annual certification, that it doesn't have that type of compensation plan. The government can use that evidence to try to establish that this individual underwriter on that occasion acted improperly, knowingly.
What if senior executives said, this is completely made up, completely hypothetical, but said, don't bother pulling credit scores. Send around a memo, don't bother pulling credit scores for a loan. Individual officer does all the paperwork for the loan, doesn't pull the credit score, signs it. Imagine on the form it says, I've checked the credit score. So the individual has done a false claim, signed it when it said, I've done a credit score, didn't do a credit score, but just did it because that was a dictate from senior management.
Assuming that the underwriter knowingly certified falsely, that would be a potential violation. If they could establish that the individual underwriter did it, whether or not she did it at direction, the knowing is the point to establish false claim that liability. Your Honors, I think we need to step back for just a second here. The things that you're struggling with are things that Judge Collier never reached because she never got past step one, which was She had a very, at the government's urging, a very narrow interpretation of what this release was all about and said it stops at the claim itself. It doesn't extend to conduct. She says that very clearly. And that's error. The proper course at this time would be to remand the case to Judge Collier with the proper interpretation and let the parties develop the record that would be necessary to determine whether the conduct that's being alleged in New York is violative of that interpretation. That's the right course here. And you can't have, at most, Your Honor, at most, you have two reasonable interpretations. At most. We think it's unambiguous in our end, but at most you have two reasonable interpretations because we have language in the text that this court may not ignore that says paragraph 3B releases conduct.
I know that you want the case to be remanded because you think her interpretation is wrong. But assuming that we agree with her and thought her interpretation was correct, would there be any reason for us to remand the Southern District of New York's decision for her to decide it in the first instance, if we agree with her?
No, the Southern District of New York judge accepted the Judge Collier's interpretation, didn't try to second guess it, and applied that to the complaint. We're not asking and don't think it would necessarily be appropriate to, if you're going to come up with the same interpretation, ask Judge Collier to second guess Judge Furman. What we want is Judge Collier to apply the correct interpretation, which says, again, she didn't get past step one. And I know you want to get to the solely and the conduct and what's in the New York complaint and what's not in the New York complaint and what theories are viable and what theories are not viable, but you don't get there until you have an interpretation that you can apply against those considerations. And the Deutsche Bank matter, Your Honor, I just want to mention that because it's extremely important. The court understand that that was a theory of liability. It is not a case. It doesn't have any precedential value. And when you look at the Deutsche Bank case and the release in the Deutsche Bank case, the release was for conduct. If that's the theory that the government was pursuing.
But the Deutsche Bank settlement specifically said any civil or administrative monetary claim the United States has for the covered conduct.
Right, and the covered conduct was failure to implement a quality control plan.
I understand, but you don't have that language in yours. Your release is written differently.
My point is the government is saying that's what they intended to put in paragraph 3B. How is that consistent with Judge Collier's interpretation that it wasn't conduct? The government is trying to introduce what it thought, what it meant to include in paragraph 3B. That, of course, is extrinsic evidence. And you only get to extrinsic evidence if there's some ambiguity in the interpretation.
Thank you, counsel.
Didn't you, when you said both arguments are reasonable, that's quite a concession, isn't it?
No, I said.
I mean, you said no. That's what you said. You said both approaches are reasonable, and then you said you think ours is unambiguous. How can that be? How can you have an unambiguously clear reading, which is yours, and yet say the government's reading is also reasonable?
Let me be clear.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe absolutely.
I'll give you
clear.
A chance to do that.
If I said that, I misspoke. Our interpretation, we believe, is clear on this question about whether the paragraph 3B releases conduct or not.
Okay.
It's very clear. From the text of 3B, the description of conduct, and from the other paragraphs that...
And is your argument that the interpretation of 3B turns on that?
That's the threshold question. As we talked about earlier.
Right.
If the court were to accept these other theories, these other interpretations by the government as being reasonable, that doesn't mean ours is unreasonable. It just means you have two reasonable interpretations at that point.
Okay. All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.